From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. This is part three of our series on food, culture, and race, other people's food. And this episode's going to be a little different.
February 1st, 1960, in Greensboro, North Carolina, Negro students launched a movement that electrified the nation, the sit-ins.
Ignoring the ancient barriers, they seated themselves at a segregated lunch counter. They were refused service. They were asked to leave, but they just sat on studying their textbooks. The police came and took them off to jail. The lunch counter was closed, the seats roped off. But the rebellious child flourished.
When those students sat down at this all-white Woolworths lunch counter in 1960, their order literally changed the world. Their sit-in sparked a whole wave of protests that helped desegregate restaurants across the South. The four black college freshmen who started it all came to be known as the Greensboro Four. And a few weeks ago, at a diner on Long Island, I actually got to meet one of them, Joseph McNeil. He told me about some of the experiences he had as a young man that led up to his protest.
It came to a head at a Richmond bus station. I ordered a hamburger and was told I had to go to the rear of the bus station. And that ticked me off. And then I realized how deep this thing was and that it was going to stay like this unless we changed it. So I went back to the dormitory that evening, confronted my friends and said, listen, we've talked and talked and talked. When are we going to act?
Like, it's such a simple thing, sitting down to eat. You know, like you and I just both walked into this diner and we sat down together to eat.
60 years ago, we tried this maneuver, we'd be confronted.
Which isn't that long ago.
In the scheme of things and lifespans, you're right on.
Right. It's so hard for me to wrap my brain around the idea that what you and I are doing right now would have been a cause for controversy.
Segregation was pervasive. It was everywhere. Even in a McDonald's, you were required to go to the rear of a McDonald's and place your order. And of course, we all know the absurdity of colored water, colored access to the beach, no access to hotels if you're traveling and you're tired.
And so that moment, you walk into the Woolworths on that day, February 1st, 1960, and you go and you sit down on this stool at the counter where no African-American, as far as we know, had ever sat at that counter. And you take that seat. And what was going through your head in that moment where you first sat down?
There's lots of uncertainty. How was the crowd of people who gathered around us going to react? How was the store manager going to react? But we faced at that time the possibility of arrest. We were aware of people who defied segregation. We were aware of what happened to Emmett Till. So all these things were operating in the background because it could have happened to us.
I know there was one moment several hours into that first day sitting there where a cop came in and he started sort of brandishing his club.
Yes.
He was walking back and forth. You guys are sitting at the counter in a row of four of you, and he's sort of, sounds like he was sort of pacing back and forth behind you, tapping his club into his hand.
Threatening, menacing.
Right.
Other patrons started to gather around saying, you see those four colored boys over there? And the word started to spread that four colored boys were sitting down at a Woolworth store saying they're not going to leave until they're served. There was an elderly white woman. She was watching the scene from the time we sat down. And she got up and started walking towards us. And Frank McCain says, McNeil, here comes trouble.
Frank McCain, one of the other four of you.
Yes. And we sat there, and the woman came behind McCain and I. She put her hand on his shoulder and on my shoulder and said words like, boys, I'm disappointed in you. And then McCain says, ma'am, why would you be disappointed in me? You don't know me. And that woman said, I'm disappointed at what you're doing, because it's taken you so long. And that was like a shot of adrenaline. She, in a sense, was our first outside friend.
Over the next few days, they gained more friends, black and white, but also a lot of enemies. Some white people in town started getting to Woolworths early to fill up all the seats, so Joe and the others couldn't take them. Things in the restaurant were tense for days. The sit-in continued, and the movement just kept growing. Within a few weeks, demonstrations had spread to 250 U.S. cities and towns. At one point, the Greensboro protesters were arrested, but fortunately, things there never turned violent. The same can't be said for some of those other protests.
In Jackson, Mississippi this year, a sit-in group, including whites as well as Negroes, stoically faced a moment of grotesque violence. One Negro student, Memphis Norman, was dragged from his stool and brutally beaten. Norman, who had offered no resistance, was arrested, as well as his assailant.
Back in Greensboro, it took several months of sit-ins, negotiations, and, frankly, bad press and lost profits for Woolworths. But finally, in July, the chain announced they'd desegregate lunch counters nationwide.
The South reacted violently, but sit-ins were almost an immediate success. Hundreds of lunch counters, hotels, and theaters were desegregated.
I should say here, we're giving you the short version of what happened in this story. We don't mean to suggest that this change came quick or easy by any stretch. If you want the full story, check out the great Smithsonian documentary, Seizing Justice. It's available online. We'll link to it at sporkful.com. So after 6 months, Mr. McNeil and the other protesters were victorious. As I sat with him at the diner, he described his first visit to that lunch counter after it was desegregated.
All that blood, sweat, and tears that was put into this effort to integrate this lunch counter, I had not been a patron. So I think I ordered apple pie and coffee. And it was not good coffee, it was bad coffee. And the apple pie was, as the kids today would say, the apple pie sucked.
Why did it suck? What made it not good?
It was just blah, it's plain apple pie. Certainly not something you'd want to break a leg over. You know?
But come on now, on some level, that pie must have tasted good.
Yeah, the sense of a false sense of victory, it was good.
I feel like I want to have a slice of pie with you. Will you have a slice of pie with me?
I think we ought to do that.
All right. All right, what kind of pie do you have?
Pie, we have apple pie, cherry pie, blueberry.
I think it's a pretty easy decision, right?
Some of your finest apple pie.
All right, we'll take two slices of apple pie. Could I please have mine with vanilla ice cream? Would you
I'll
like
pass
yours?
On the ice cream.
Okay.
You got it.
Thank you. As Mr. McNeil and I spent more time talking and reminiscing, it became clear to me that he's actually sort of the perfect person to have played this crucial role in integrating our nation's restaurants. I mean, he's thoughtful and principled and courageous, but also, he loves to eat. Can we talk, though, for a minute about apple pie?
Sure.
So we've established that the apple pie at Woolworths, on a literal level, did not taste very good, although the satisfaction of your accomplishment made it taste a little bit less bad.
I like the way you put that.
Okay. Tell me about your favorite apple pie.
I like lots of cinnamon.
Okay.
But we all have expectations of apple pies with not too much crust.
What about a la mode?
It can disguise ordinary pie.
So you think ice cream is added to ordinary pie to make it better?
Mm-hmm.
But great pie doesn't need it?
Great pie can stand on its own.
Where, on a typical slice of pie, where's your favorite bite?
I'm in the middle.
Middle man.
Yes, sir.
So you like some crust, but mostly filling.
Exactly.
Because that tip of the point there, sometimes there's almost no crust because that center of the pie crust, the bottom crust gets too soggy and mushy. It gets mushed down.
I love it when people talk about food. We live to eat.
Yeah. But isn't that something that makes what you did so powerful? Because eating is such a simple, basic, universal human act.
Yeah. To deny the ability to eat well, you really have to be a monster of some type.
That's right. I agree. Oh, here we go.
Oh, you did well.
Oh, yes. You did not skimp on the ice cream.
Can you sleep here? Thank you.
All right. We're digging into the pie. This is really good. So, Mr. McNeil, how do you rate this apple pie?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd make this a 6 to 7.
6 to 7? Call it 6.5?
We'll be generous, 7.
Okay, 7. And just so we have a control or a baseline, what number would you give to that Woolworth pie in 1960?
Oh, that's a 3 or 4.
Let's be less generous.
3.
3. All right, well, that's progress.
We're going to make progress sometimes in spite of ourselves. I tell people today, when they point out the fact that the system's broken, well, damn it, fix it. If you don't fix it, who else will?
I agree. I want to make sure that I say thank you to you for everything you did to help our country. It's really been an honor for me to get to meet you in person and hear your story and to share a meal with you, share a slice of apple pie. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Joe McNeil went on to serve in the Air Force and to lead a successful business career. He lives now with his wife outside New York City and still goes back to Greensboro every year to visit family and friends. Coming up over the next 2 days, we're going to drop parts 4 and 5 of our series on food, race, and culture, Other People's Food. These upcoming shows were just taped live on stage with actress Rosie Perez.
When I went to Puerto Rico, I was like, this is me. All the tastes are familiar. And even the new foods just felt right to me. And I felt a part of things.
Artist Ashok Kondabolu, a.k.a. Dap, formerly of Das Racist.
The dominant culture is going to take my culture's food and repackage it and quote-unquote elevate it because the food that they ate it on stinks. Why don't you elevate your mom's crappy casseroles and like your tuna fish sandwiches and do that?
And comedian Michelle Buteau. That's the last 2 episodes in our series, which will drop tomorrow and the next day. While you wait for those, check out the video that Dap and I made. We took to the streets of New York to play a game called Is This Food Racist? We played with anyone who would talk to us. That video is up now at Sporkful.com. Of course, you can also check out parts 1 and 2 of this series. We ask what happens when a white chef gets famous for cooking Mexican food, and an African-American cookbook author explains why she won't eat fried chicken with me. You can find those podcasts wherever you got this one. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Engineering help from Irene Trudell. Music help from Black Label Music. Thanks to the Carl Place Diner on Long Island, where I went with Mr. McNeil. Also, special thanks to Rebecca Carroll, Arun Venugopal, and Paula Schumann, and to Brenda Williams-Butts, Caledonia Kearns, and WNYC's Diversity Council, especially Irva Gunja, Richard Yeh, Lee Hill, and Sarah Gonzalez. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
Hi, this is Mark Pashan from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.